You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works Volume 75 by Rudolf Steiner, 8 lecture/discussions, entitled Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences, translated by Sabine Seiler. This is the last lecture, which is a discussion in the book, Lecture 8. And I believe it's given after the lecture we just heard. Walter Birkett, Chairman. I want to thank Dr. Steiner for the lecture he has presented here. And I want to announce that a discussion is to follow now. Please turn in requests to speak and your questions here in writing. Dr. Dobrina, ladies and gentlemen, after such a powerful picture of the current and past spiritual and intellectual history of humanity has been presented to us, it is not easy to sum everything up concisely in a few succinct words. But I think before going on to a critique, we must first appreciate the profundity of what we have heard. We must appreciate and thus acknowledge that a synthesis is being sought here of the natural sciences, with their exact lines of thought, and spiritual science, with its somewhat antiquated forms. Indeed, the natural sciences have been able in the past centuries to mount the throne and to dethrone even philosophy as in part antiquated. But now those who are not satisfied with philosophy, thus toppled, and thrown out of the realm of the gods, are looking for an impulse to bring philosophy back onto the old podium on which it stood in ancient Greece. And I believe that anthroposophy, as Dr. Steiner described it here, is an attempt to shape that synthesis in such a way that, in the first preliminary stages, he acknowledges the natural sciences, and makes an effort not to say anything against their exactness, in order to then move beyond them and advance them into the supersensory realm. That step into the supersensory worlds seems to me to rest on a weak foundation, and all the more so as Dr. Steiner works with concepts such as pre-existence. If there were more time available, one could ask more pointedly about what Dr. Steiner means by this pre-existence, or what nonsense he might still have to say about the post-mortem life, the life after death. And there is applause. Dr. Dobrina continues. At any rate, I believe that from this standpoint we can and must right away begin a strong discussion with him. And in the course of the discussion, it will become clear that Dr. Steiner's entire concept formation falls really into two entirely different spheres. On the one hand, he makes an effort to plunge into therapy and to examine Hellenism, in particular, with regard to therapeutic analysis. On the other hand, he works with concepts taken out of the old toolbox of theosophy and strongly reminiscent of quite antiquated forms of spiritual life. Applause again. Dr. Dobrina continues. For this reason, I want to say very briefly that the total picture that Dr. Steiner presented in his lecture here, as well as in his previous public lecture, seems rather inadequate to me, and that on this basis we cannot come to any critique of modern life, or of the struggles in the economy, or of the now prevalent opinion against spiritual powers that have fallen into decay. Applause again. And Dr. Dobrina continues. Perhaps Dr. Steiner will be so kind as to respond to this briefly. Walter Birkett. Do those assembled take these statements as a question that Dr. Steiner should address right away? If so, I would like to ask Dr. Steiner to please respond to these statements. And there is applause. And now, Rudolf Steiner. Ladies and gentlemen, as I said at the beginning, my lecture today was intended merely as an introduction. And as I said in an introductory lecture, one faces the difficulty of only being able to indicate and suggest points that really need further explanation and clarification. And as a result, of course, a whole flood of unsatisfactory and unanswered points accumulates in the souls of the listeners that cannot all be resolved or clarified in the first lecture. The previous speaker's comments, I can't call them objections, concern the fact that he found the terms I used to be old concepts. Now, ladies and gentlemen, all our words, even the most ordinary ones, can be included in this category. When we want to express ourselves, to speak at all, we must use words. If you try to survey what is available in the literature of our day, which seems colossal even to me, I mean colossal here in regard to its abundance, for example, if you want to read all that was written by me, and there is laughter, Steiner continues, then faced with such an abundance, it is no wonder that in an initial introductory lecture, some things can only be indicated. Now, let's look more closely at what the esteemed previous speaker just said. He said that pre-existence reminds him of old concepts. But he has been reminded of old concepts only because I used words that have already been in existence in earlier times. Of course, I said that by raising imaginative cognition, which I have characterized, to inspired cognition, which I have also characterized, we arrive at the conviction of pre-existence. When I only describe how in this way we arrive at the intuition of pre-existing life, then the term pre-existence itself does not really matter. What matters is only that I explain how, through exact exercises, we can come to perceive what element of the human being existed before that human essence, if I may express it this way, united with the physical body, with what was being prepared in the mother's body through conception. Thus I use the term pre-existence only to point to something that we can see only if we have developed suprasensory knowledge in the way I described. In Gnosis we find a certain attitude toward this knowledge. Gnosticism as such has nothing to do with what Anthroposophy now intends. But that attitude toward knowledge that was present in the ancient Gnosis and that aims at understanding the suprasensory, that attitude has come alive again in our era, that is, in the era after Galileo, after Copernicus, in a new form. And now I want to tell you in more detail what would still have to be added. I will try to describe it in just a few sentences. You see, when you look back from the perspective of the knowledge we strive for, with the methods I discussed, to an earlier type of knowledge that is very different from the one I described here, then you see an Eastern form of knowledge that could actually also be called theosophical. It was only after that form of knowledge had developed in earlier ages that a philosophy came forth out of theosophy, and then out of that philosophy came Anthroposophy. Of course, if we understand these concepts in such a way that we retain only their abstractness rather than what matters, then we get everything jumbled up, and what is new will appear to us only as a warmed-up version of the old. This theosophy was achieved through very different methods of knowing than the ones I have described here. What was the essence of that method of knowledge? I don't mean all of it, but only a certain phase of them. For example, there was the yoga process of ancient India, and that is definitely not to be warmed up and rehashed in Anthroposophy. We see this from the fact that what I described seems initially to be quite similar to this yoga process, doesn't it? But if you don't read this into what I said, you will not find that what I describe is similar to the yoga process. That process is based on the fact that at a certain stage of humanity's development, when all of human life was less differentiated than is the case in our era, people sensed that there was a connection between the rhythmical process of breathing and the process of thinking. Today we look at the matter from the point of view of physiology, and we know that as we breathe in, we push at the same time the force of the breath through the spinal canal. That is, we push the air we breathe into the brain. The breathing process then continues in the brain in a metamorphosed way, so that you have, seen physiologically, a synthesis of the breathing process and the thinking process. This is the process on which yoga was based. Yoga transformed the usual process of breathing into a differently regulated breathing. As a result of the changed breathing process, that is due to a physical bodily process, thinking was changed. It was transformed in such a way as to make possible a certain conception in the old instinctive sense. In our time, we live in a differentiated human organization, and therefore we now have to tackle the thinking process directly. And that is also why we arrive at a very different result. When you look at the concrete details, you will be able to clearly delineate the distinct phases of knowledge as they occurred one after the other in humanity's development. And then you will no longer even come close to the idea that what anthroposophy, as the way of attaining higher knowledge that is appropriate to our time, offers the present era, can in any way be lumped together with what was available in ancient times. Of course, we cannot debate what I have not even spoken about on the basis of what I told you in an introductory lecture. Naturally, I would have to continue now and explain further what pre-existent life is like. In my introductory lecture, I have not been able to say anything more than that knowledge of pre-existent life is achieved through the processes described, which are indeed different from what has ever been present before in history in terms of human beings' inner development. And now, I would really like to ask what justification there is for criticism when I use the word pre-existence in the sense in which everyone can understand it. It does not mean anything more than what the word says. When I understand existence to mean everything that is experienced through the senses and then speak of pre-existence, then obviously I am referring to an existence in the spiritual soul life prior to sensory existence. This does not point to some old theosophy. I am simply using a word that would have to be explained in more detail if we were to go beyond a merely introductory presentation. Thus, if you really want to know more about theosophy, and want to look at what I have described in my book, which I also titled Theosophy, you will find that its beginnings can be traced to ancient forms, much like the beginnings of the chemistry of our time can be traced to alchemy. But the process of knowledge that I have described today is in no way similar to any process of knowledge from ancient times. Therefore, it is completely impossible that what will follow today's lecture and what thus has not yet been said, can be made the subject of our discussion by claiming that pre-existence comes out of an old toolbox. As you no doubt observed if you followed the lecture, it does not come out of an old collection of tools, but rather continues certain attitudes toward knowledge that also existed back then, when the old tools were still in use and not yet considered old. Nowadays, we have only vestiges of these old tools. They project into our time as religious beliefs, whereas in earlier times they were the result of processes of knowledge. Now we must once again, by way of processes of knowledge that are organized along the lines of the knowledge of the natural sciences, arrive at conceptions that can imbue the entire human being, not only the intellectually oriented human being. Ladies and gentlemen, anyone who wants to criticize something in any way must direct the criticism to what was actually said, and not to something that could not be said in the lecture, and of which it is then claimed that it was not supported, or was unfounded, or the like. How can something be unfounded that was merely a simple description? As in all my introductory lectures, I have done nothing more than describe something. Only those who know what happens when one really takes these things up would be able to say that something was unsubstantiated. Really, taking these things up means no longer just speaking about them from the outside. Then you will see that these things have a much deeper foundation than any mathematical science, because they come much closer to the sphere of the soul than the mathematical processes do. And therefore, such a critique is an extraordinarily superficial one. Indeed, always being understood only in this superficial, external way is precisely what makes it so extraordinarily difficult for anthroposophy to establish itself. In no other science do people expect that just one lecture will give them everything. Only anthroposophy is expected to be given in its entirety in one lecture. I have said from the outset that I cannot do that. Applause, Steiner continues. The point here is not that I describe the old tools that are still available. For example, how the Gnostics in inner soul processes arrived at that sort of knowledge. Or how the Eastern yoga schools arrived at knowledge. People who know those tools, instead of just talking about them, applause, will then no longer claim that anthroposophy is reminiscent of the old. People can make that claim only as long as they allow reminiscences to come to them in the form of abstract concepts that owe their existence simply to the fact that they have not yet been compared to the concrete, to reality. Of course, I could go on much longer, but this may suffice as an answer for now. Lively applause. Then, Mr. H. Schmidt. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to criticize something, or rather place a question mark next to it, namely the following. Dr. Steiner said this evening that every scientific worldview is dualistic, in the sense that to what is immediate and certain, it must add what is uncertain. It is obvious that where anthroposophy is concerned, this other element is the supersensory world. But the scientific value of a philosophy lies in the degree to which it succeeds in presenting the inner relationship between the supersensory world and the sensory realm. Please note that I intentionally use the expression scientific value, and am not speaking about the cultural or psychological value. For example, Platonism, which did not succeed all that often in constructing the relationship between idea and reality, had an immense cultural significance. Now, in anthroposophy, Dr. Steiner is trying to show the relationship between the supersensory and the sensory realms. That is, he is trying to show the necessary transition from the immediate sensory world to the supersensory world, or seen subjectively, from empirical and rational knowledge, from scientific knowledge, to, if you will, super-scientific knowledge. For this purpose, he uses anthroposophy. I am basing what I say only on Dr. Steiner's lecture and primarily on its first part. Quite frankly, my ability was not sufficient for the second part. Applause. H. Schmidt continues. Anthroposophy relies on the analogy to mathematics. Dr. Steiner explained how we project mathematics into nature. As we know, this was already established in the sciences of ancient Greece and is also well known. It is at any rate the ideal of the mathematical natural sciences to mathematize nature, as the ancients already put it. But in what sense can this be spoken of at all? That is the problem. Dr. Steiner explained with what emotion, with what passion, and with what personal involvement individual mathematicians assert their ideas of conceptual things in empirical reality. But what are the forms and constructions mathematicians are dealing with? These are not their ideas. For example, a circle a mathematician draws on the blackboard in order to demonstrate geometrical theorems, that circle is not the mathematician's idea. As a human being, he has nothing whatever to do with that circle. Perhaps he has nothing to do with it as a mathematician either, but as a human being only insofar as he uses his two eyes to perceive the circle. There is commotion, Schmidt continues. The concept of the circle that the mathematician is obviously dealing with cannot be presented in reality at all. It is never an object of sensory perception. Rather, the concept of the circle is a general one. Now, anthroposophy in particular needs something personal and real that it wants to project into nature. The general concepts that I have in my mathematical mind, so to speak, do not exist anywhere in reality. Thus, if the suprasensory world is to be based upon the sensory world, in such a way that we can extrapolate from the subject to the object, then this can never be achieved by projecting subjective ideas into nature as mathematics does with its ideas. Therefore, the mathematical analogy in particular is not at all suited for this purpose, because mathematics is dealing with concepts that as such do not ever exist in reality. In my view, this is an objection to anthroposophy as a whole. On the other hand, today's lecture in particular emphasized the reality of supersensory things. Thus, my point is that I cannot see how mathematics is to serve here to explain the bridge from the sensory realm to the supersensory one. The main value of today's lecture was apparently the point that personal experience, personal excitement, indeed the totality of personal experience, is to be actively involved in thinking. But that must raise a concern in everyone, for the personal, the individual element, in particular, lacks necessity. What I personally envision, well, anybody can then say to me, it's only your fantasy, your imagination, and I have nothing to do with that. That, in my view, is an objection to anthroposophy as a whole. Applause. And then what was particularly important to Dr. Steiner, in the inner sympathy and engagement that his lecture evoked precisely at that point, it was indeed moving even for his opponents, namely the statement that Dr. Steiner sees moral intuition as the starting point for higher knowledge. Anthroposophy needs something supersensory from which to derive moral principles. And it achieves this derivation, in particular, by perceiving the supersensory. And that, quite frankly, I don't understand. Let us assume for the moment that there is a suprasensory cognitive faculty, or rather, such cognitive faculties that we ordinary mortals do not yet have, and that it would indeed be possible to perceive the supersensory with this higher cognitive faculty, to see the supersensory realm as something really existing. How can I see from that what I ought to do? What I ought to do can never be derived from what is. There is no bridge from the sphere of what is to the sphere of what ought to be. Walter Burkicht. Since, for the time being, there are no other requests to speak, I ask Dr. Steiner to please respond to this. Rudolf Steiner. Ladies and gentlemen, to begin with, I want to say the following. On the whole, the nature of what I said this evening prevented me from speaking of analogy at the point where I talked about mathematics. And I ask you to remember carefully that I did not use the term analogy. That is no accident, but entirely deliberate. I could not use the word analogy because I was not talking about an analogy to mathematics. Rather, I used mathematical thinking to characterize the inner experience of certainty. And by trying to clarify how one arrives at an inner experience of certainty in mathematics, I wanted to show how in a very different sphere, where one tries to arrive at certainty in the same way, it is indeed possible to come to that same degree of certainty. Thus, it is not a question of an analogy to mathematics. Rather, it is a matter of presenting two real types of soul experience that are to be compared in nothing other than by reference to the attainment of inner certainty. Ladies and gentlemen, what the previous speaker said, therefore, does not follow on from my lecture. For if it did, he could not have used the word analogy. I have avoided that word because it does not belong there. Moreover, the previous speaker said that I spoke of the passion and enthusiasm of the individual mathematician. But that too cannot be the case, because I simply referred to the nature of the mathematical experience familiar to those who are initiated, schooled in mathematics. It is unfathomable to me how one can even come up with the idea of any personal meddling in mathematics. By contrast, I want to make the following comments. It sounds very nice to say that the inner concept of the circle has nothing whatever to do with the circle I draw on the blackboard, and of course I will not maintain that it has anything to do with the circle I draw, because it does not even cross my mind to say that the inner concept of the circle consists of chalk. This expresses no particularly profound truth, I would say. But when we move from the abstract kind of thinking to a kind of thinking that is in accordance with reality, then we have to realize the following. Let's imagine something we inwardly construct mathematically. For example, the following theorem. When we draw the diameter of a circle and then connect one endpoint of the diameter with a line to any random point on the circumference of the circle, and from this point then draw another line to the other endpoint of the diameter, then the angle we get there is always a right angle. I don't even need to draw this on the blackboard for you to prove it. What I realized there, namely that in a circle every angle above the circumference with its apex on the periphery is a right angle, is an inner experience. I don't need to use the circle on the blackboard here. And there's a shout from the audience. That's not true. Only when you have looked at it can you do the construction afterward. Steiner continuing. But without a doubt, what I draw outwardly on the blackboard is only an external aid. It is completely out of the question that people who can think mathematically would not be able to construct such mathematical truths, even the most complicated of such truths, purely in their inner experience. There is no question of that. Even if I had to rely on drawing those truths with chalk, that would still be irrelevant for the simple reason that the substantial validity of the theorem may be illustrated in the drawing, but does not have to be determined by it. If I illustrate for myself with the drawing on the blackboard that the angle is a right angle, this illustration does not say anything specific about the theorem's inner validity. And that is the important thing. There can be no question of first needing the drawing on the blackboard. But even if I did need the drawing, this would be completely irrelevant regarding what I have said about the nature of mathematizing, not about solving individual problems, but about mathematizing as such. What is crucial here lies in an entirely different sphere from what we have just discussed. For when we look at mathematizing, we are led to the insight that we experience inner truths. I also did not say that in mathematics we already experience realities. Therefore, it is entirely irrelevant when someone objects that mathematics as such does not contain any reality. In its formal aspects, it does indeed contain truths, and these can also be experienced. The path is important. It matters how we arrive at the truth and how we arrive at knowledge, even though both initially have no reality within mathematics itself. But when we now transfer this mathematical experience to an entirely different sphere, namely to the one where we now apply the precision of mathematics to the real life of the soul, then the character of the precision we have first experienced in the mathematical formal sphere will be carried into the real. And only then do we have the right to carry into reality what is valid in mathematics only as a formal element. I have shown first how we arrive from the inside at truths that we seemingly transfer, albeit only in an external way, as unreality to observation, to experiments, or that we weave into experiments. And I showed how this formal character metamorphoses into a real one. But even then, what seems so plausible still does not apply, namely, that what is mathematical lives only in me, that the concept lives only in me, and does not live out there in reality, that what has been investigated and developed mathematically as such has nothing to do with reality. For does the concept of the circle really live only within me? Let's assume I don't draw a circle on the blackboard, but I have here my two fingers, and hold a string there, and set an object in circular motion, so that a small lead ball moves in a circle. The laws of motion that I now recognize by seeing them mathematically, do they have nothing to do with reality? I always proceed precisely in such a way that I determine the method in reality through mathematics. The way I proceed, then, as I move from induction to deduction, is that I bring in what I initially found through induction, and then process it further with mathematics. When I put the end product of an empirical induction into a mathematical formula, and then simply continue with the calculations, then I count on what I develop mathematically through deduction as corresponding to reality. Because of that, only the mathematical is fruitful for reality, and not because of such philosophical arguments as have been presented here. Let us look at the fruitfulness of mathematics for reality. We can see this fruitfulness simply when, after realizing that there are irregularities deviating from the calculations, people say they will add another mathematical quantity into the calculation. And this is how we arrive at assuming a reality in a purely mathematical way. The reality turns up later. It is simply there. Thus, by continuing my empirical path purely through mathematics, I have shown that what is experienced inwardly can be applied to the outside world. At least I count on that. If we could not count on the fact that the real course of events we observe in the sensory visible world up to a certain point continues in our calculations, then what I have been talking about would not be possible at all, namely, that we feel satisfied in mathematics. What matters is that we take the concepts seriously as they have been explained here. Now, to the comment regarding what I said about moral intuition. As you may remember, in my lecture I said that intuition, which I called the third stage of suprasensory knowledge and perception, appears last. But moral intuition appears already in ordinary consciousness. It is the only suprasensory capacity that already penetrates from the suprasensory world into consciousness at our level. Moral intuition is simply an intuition on a higher level that is projected down to our level of knowledge. I have clearly shown this in my lecture. That is why I spoke first about this moral intuition instead of waiting with it until later. I named it the starting point. We learn to recognize it, and when we have understood it correctly, we have a certain subjective precondition for understanding what comes after that. For when we compare with our usual reality, what we experience in moral intuition, we find that the latter has a different kind of reality, namely, quote, ought reality, close quote, the reality of ought. If you pay attention to the details of what I said, you will see that the difference between what is and what ought to be simply arises from the fact that the moral intuition projects into the sphere of our ordinary consciousness, while the higher intuition is not a projecting down, but must be actively achieved by us. I didn't say anything about moral intuition being some kind of special case in the process of knowing general intuition. Rather, it is simply the first case where something intuitive appears in our ordinary consciousness, in our current state of consciousness. Thus, what matters here is a precise understanding of the concepts that are developed for anthroposophy. I wanted to give you suggestions. I fully understand that objections are possible, because naturally not everything can be explained in this detailed way, and so I assume that there are still many doubts in the souls of those present here. But just think how long my lecture would have needed to be if I had tried in this way to clear away those doubts in my lecture, the doubts I am now trying to clear up in my answer. All this is to be expected in a first introductory lecture, and not only in anthroposophy, but in all areas. That's what the lecture today was about. I did not at all intend to offer something all-inclusive and final. And I must say that some people absolutely do not want to accept anthroposophy at all. But I have found that often those who come to know anthroposophy best are not the ones who take a liking to it right away. Rather, the best workers in anthroposophy are often the ones who have overcome bitter doubts. Therefore, please do not take what I said with some severity in my reply, as though it were meant in a hostile way. On the whole, I am pleased with everything that is objected to here, because only if we can clear away these hurdles of objections can we actually enter into anthroposophy. And I have always felt more satisfied with those who have come to anthroposophy over the hurdles of rejection and doubt than with those who came to anthroposophy right away and in full sail. There is lively applause. Then Mr. Wilhelm. I don't want to criticize anything, but only want to ask a question, and would be very interested in Dr. Steiner's answer. Dr. Steiner replied to the criticism of the first speaker, who compared theosophy and anthroposophy, saying that anthroposophy's method of knowledge is very different from that of theosophy, particularly the old theosophy, and that in all of history, not anywhere, can any reference or hint be found regarding the method of knowledge presented by Dr. Steiner this evening. I just want to ask in this connection whether Dr. Steiner is familiar with certain passages entitled The Green Face, a book that has a strong theosophical tinge, where that method of knowledge actually forms the foundation of the entire work. I would be very interested in knowing Dr. Steiner's position on this. Rudolf Steiner. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to point out first of all that if there really are echoes reminiscent of what I have said this evening in that book titled The Green Face, which was published a few years ago, then it would be possible to trace this to anthroposophy. And there is a shout, "Never!" Steiner continues. I've only said in general that this would not be contradictory, but now that someone here shouted, "Never!" I am in full agreement, for I find nothing anthroposophical in The Green Face, but rather find that what is said in that book about anthroposophy is based on methods of knowledge with which I want nothing to do. That is what I have to say to that. This is the end of this last lecture discussion, Lecture 8, and the end of the book, Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences, Foundations and Methods, translated by Sabine Seiler, and it is Collected Works, Volume 75.